Featuring Miriam Gurman of Radcast.org, activist Lloyd Marbit, John Bertucci, Dan Serres, Chuck Johnson, and Malcolm Chaddock. We'll hear more about who these folks are and their connection with this issue in the program. Do stay tuned, won't you?
Thanks for coming out tonight. My name is Mimi Gurman, and some of you know me as Miriam. I helped organize a group a long time ago called No Nukes Northwest. It was during the Occupy days. And we decided that it was time to talk about Hanford and what was going on up the river from us. So during Occupy, we created a group of occupiers, and we went up to Hanford and had a big rally to talk about what was going on up there. And it was an exciting day. Lloyd Marbit came up, and he spoke on our stage, and Chuck Johnson, who's on the panel tonight too, came up and spoke, and Dr. Helen Caldicott came out and spoke about all of the things that we need to know regarding how our world is getting screwed up by nuclear power. And I could use, you know, really soft, pretty words about it, but it's not nice, you know? We're really getting radiated. And we need to know what to do, and we need to know how to cope with this, and we need to know before all of that what exactly is happening to us from Fukushima, from Hanford, from the Columbia Generating Station, and from nukes in general across the U.S. and across the seas. So that's what tonight is about. It's about your questions. I've had many, many questions, and I go to my teachers, who are citizens with Geiger counters, who've been doing this for a lot longer than I have. My teachers are Helen Caldicott and Paul Gunter of Beyond Nuclear, and Lloyd was a wonderful teacher of mine when I was preparing for Hanford, and just on, the list goes on and on of who my teachers are, and mostly my teachers are people like you. And when you leave today or tonight, I want you to become teachers for your friends. And the way to become a teacher to your friends about nuclear issues is to learn a new fact, just a fact. And you take that fact and you tell somebody that fact. They might be interested in hearing it, they might not. Chances are they've never heard anything that you have to say before. It's a good chance. And then you become a teacher. It's as simple as that. You don't need to be an expert. Tonight is for you to become more of an expert than you were when you walked in the door. So when I introduce the panelists and the moderator, they're going to talk, they're going to give you a little bit of background about why they're here, and you're going to ask as many questions as you have. And if you don't have questions, or you haven't formulated questions yet, you probably will in the course of tonight, and you'll have an opportunity to ask them, because it's all about you. So one of the things I wanted to share tonight, if I have it. If I don't, it's a message from the gods that I'm just supposed to remember this stuff. Sustainability. I hear this word all the time in Portland. I hear this word in different communities. And I ask myself, knowing as much as I do know about what's coming in overhead from Fukushima in particular, does anybody know what they're talking about when they talk about sustainability? It's a rhetorical question. So yeah, sustainability. We have fallout from Fukushima coming down, and we don't know much about it, and yet we use this word sustainability. And I ask myself, and I'm just posing this question to all of you, what is sustainable when you have nuclear fallout? For me, there's not a whole lot that is sustainable. What are we sustaining? And I don't mean to sound like a downer, but this is a reality now. And the reality in what we wake up to every day and what we go to sleep to every day and what our children go play in every day is a brand new reality, and we cannot see it. It's completely invisible, and people are dying from it. And, you know, I might as well just lay it all out, right? We have a lot of people getting sick on the West Coast from it. We just don't hear about it unless you look for it and know where to go to look for it. A lot of people dying in Japan from it. And we talk about sustainability. Oh, I'm going to create this really cool house that's really sustainable. Sustainable to what? What I know is at Hanford, they have tanks, 177 tanks, that were built to sustain, as long as possible, highly radioactive nuclear sludge. And that didn't work. Those tanks are all starting to leak. And they created double shell tanks to sustain the same stuff that was in the single shell tanks. It's not sustainable. You can't keep this stuff in. And if you can't keep that stuff in, you think that we can keep nuclear fallout out? We can't do that either. So the question becomes, well, what do we do? And that's a big question. And I don't have one answer. I don't think anybody has an answer, or we have many answers. You know, we have probabilities, possibilities, and we need to start to bring in the community now, and scientists into this community now, and doctors into this community now to help us learn what our possible answers are, what we're supposed to do with this. And we can't do any of that until we understand what's going on. So it brings me back full circle to now. What's going on? We have a responsibility, in my opinion, to tell the truth about all of this. And again, what I'm telling you right now, it's a major bummer. And it's not pretty. And, you know, getting sick isn't pretty. None of it's pretty. But we can become empowered by it. Because we get empowered by the truth, and we figure out what we need to do for ourselves. We figure out, well, okay, if we know that we're having a high fallout day, well, we can at least keep our kids inside, can't we? You know, we can attempt to figure out what we can put in our soil, maybe, in our organic gardens that might help leach out some of this stuff. Will it? It's just another question to pose. You know, how do we keep our organic gardens organic? I have one. I eat from it most of the year. I take my Geiger counter out in it, and it's no longer organic. Well, it's got man-made, and it's very man-made isotopes in the ground now. So, more questions, you know. I just want to say a little bit about what I do. I started a group called Radcast. We take it upon ourselves to collect data and readings of radiation from around the world, and we radcast it out. Instead of broadcasting it, we radcast it out. So KABU, every day, Monday through Friday, at 5 o'clock on the news, will put out a radcast report, and it tells what the radiation is in different parts of Portland, in Tenino, Washington, all the way up to Seattle, Medford, anywhere we have readers who can bring in those readings about what's going on in their community. We have Geiger counters up here. One of them is the one that No Nukes Northwest uses. I currently have that at my computer doing my readings. Amy has another computer and gives us readings from Beaverton. Thank you, Amy, for that. And Amy brought a couple of counters tonight. John Bertucci, who's on the panel, he does readings all the time as well from California. We need readings in every house. The questions will start really soon. I'm going to be quiet in 2 seconds. I'll get into that later. But what you have to keep remembering is, in order to understand the truth, you really do need a Geiger counter. It's no longer a game. It's more important to you at this point than a car. And it will become your best friend. And it will tell you where to go and where not to go. And this is everything the government so far has not told us anything about. But we can help you, and the panel can help you. So I would like that to be a positive thing, because we can help each other. And that's what we have to do, because we're a community to help each other. The woman who's going to be moderating tonight, Kriana Fayalov, helps people get empowered every day. She teaches classes to help with empowerment, to help build your inner strength. Maybe sometimes to deal with stuff like this. It's important. Kriana, this is her. I invited Kriana here because we need new people to take part in this knowledge and pass this knowledge out. Again, it's our responsibility. So Kriana stepped up to learn how to do this, to learn how to be a part of our anti-nuke world. Thank you, Kriana. I'd like to introduce the panel so I can be quiet and help everybody with their questions come over here. Lloyd Marbet, over here, is from the Oregon Conservancy. He ran for Secretary of State for the Green Party. He also ran for Congress as a member of the Independent Party. I believe that our world, our local world, would have been different had he been elected. I voted for you. He took part in Don't Waste Oregon to help shut down the Trojan nuclear power plant. Lloyd is here tonight to talk about Fukushima, and many of the pamphlets over here are what Lloyd brought for you to take home with you and show your friends, make copies, do whatever. Lloyd, again, he's one of my teachers, and he should become one of your teachers. Let's see. Next to Lloyd is John Bertucci from Fukushima Response. John came up here from San Francisco to talk to you. A lot of people have seen, if you're on Facebook, something called Fukushima is Here. It happened in October, I believe, and it was on Ocean Beach. Is it Ocean Beach?
Ocean Beach.
Yeah, Ocean Beach in San Francisco. And it was a human mural saying Fukushima is here. And the photographs of it were beautiful, and people came together to sort of face Japan, face the waters, face the world, and say, it's here on our coast. So John will answer, a lot of questions. He's been answering things for me for a long time. He's part of a regional work group in San Francisco of concerned citizens. Again, meters. He's a part of our metering system. Let's see, he organizes public information events. He hosts guests, his group hosts guests from Japan. They also lobby elected officials. And I asked for his help so that we can go back to City Hall, which No Nukes Northwest did about 6 months ago, to lobby our City Hall to get Portland to become a nuke-free zone. And Amanda Fritz listened to us. She asked us to go back out into the world and get certain questions answered. I have those answers. And she'll be surprised, and I'm going to bring John in to help us with that so that we can get up to speed with Portland for the No Nukes cause. He's also got some postcards up front that you can have. Then, Dan. Dan Sears, am I pronouncing your last name right? He's just Dan to me. He's from Columbia Riverkeeper. He's also on the Hanford Advisory Board. I have been not a guest. Anybody can sit in at the Hanford Advisory Board, and I suggest you do that sometime. It's fascinating. The advisory board is made up of people who are pro-nuke and anti-nuke, who all want Hanford to be cleaned up. It's a pretty interesting group of people. And Dan is like a viper in sheep's clothing. That's how I think of you. Yeah, he's very, very damaging to authorities when they try to lie to us. Chuck Johnson is next to Dan, and he is now from Physicians for Social Responsibility. He took on the nuclear task, the task force there. And there are members here. Nancy is here. I'm here. There's different people here who work together to shut down Columbia Generating Station. And any one of you who wants to come on board with that, we have info for you. You can take part. We need to teach the Washington folks across the river that they are in charge of the Columbia Generating Station, and they can shut it down. So we encourage you to join us for that. Malcolm Chaddock and I met at Occupy. He's a member of No Nukes Northwest, and he is here to talk about local active events that go on and anything you might want to ask of No Nukes Northwest, what we do. And I'm a member of that as well. So I'm gonna pass the mic over for a moment to Kriana and then have Lloyd start up. Kriana, did you want to speak now? Do you want to say something now before we get going? Or
maybe after?
After? Okay, so Lloyd, I'm going to open it up to you. And again, I thank everybody for coming out tonight to learn the truth about what's going on. So please formulate your questions. We can stay a little bit later. Shh, don't tell the folks who run the church, but I know that. And let's get going.
I am grateful to be here, and I want to wish you all a good Human Rights Day. I understand today is Human Rights Day, and I think we should, above all things, celebrate those rights. In a day and age of ecocide, one agent of environmental destruction is nuclear power. And I have been an anti-nuclear activist for 39 years, which kind of amazes me. starting to feel old already. For the first 37 years, it was said by the nuclear industry and its regulators that the worst case accident was a single meltdown at a nuclear power plant, and the probability of it was infinitesimally small. I mean, they had major reports that reached that conclusion. On March 11th, 2011, an 8.9 earthquake occurred off the coast of Japan. It caused a 46-foot tall tsunami that hit the Fukushima nuclear complex, destroying all of its backup power systems and many of its external radiation monitors. Units 1 through 3, there were 6 units there, suffered meltdowns. 1 through 3 suffered meltdowns, and the reactor cores are now reported to be missing. Due to a hydrogen explosion, Unit 4 suffered severe damage to its spent fuel pool and blew the top off its building. The spent fuel pool is 100 feet off of the ground. The reactor vessel was empty. Everything that was in the reactor vessel is in the spent fuel pool. There were no explosions from fissioning uranium. Nuclear reactors are not like nuclear bombs. There can be steam explosions from the contact of water with the hot molten fuel, and there can be hydrogen explosions, which are caused by the zirconium cladding that is around each of the fuel assemblies. When it is exposed to air, it oxidizes and it releases hydrogen. And that was a major, major problem at Fukushima. 160,000 people were evacuated, and now they are being told that they will never go home. 2 years, 8 months, 29 days later, the Fukushima nuclear accident is still ongoing, with massive radiation leaks, conflicting reports from its owner, TEPCO, Tokyo Electric Power Company, on the extent of damage and the radiation that's being released, and the further threat of nuclear accidents occurring during cleanup. It is now estimated, and this is the latest estimate, that 300 tons, 80,000 gallons of radioactive cesium and strontium contaminated water is leaking into the Pacific daily since the beginning of the accident, totaling about 80.4 million gallons of water, or 301,500 tons of contaminated water. An estimated 400 tons, 95,860 gallons of groundwater streams into the basements of the damaged reactors each day. There's now talk of the inevitability of all radioactive contaminated water hastily stored on site being dumped into the Pacific Ocean. There is no permanent high-level radioactive waste repository in Japan. So even if they're able to retrieve the molten fuel that has melted, there really is no ultimate disposal for any of this material. What other energy facility has an accident and 1,005 days later, it is still not over, with international calls for removal of its utility owner from control of the cleanup? What other energy facility has an accident which causes severe environmental damage, huge economic costs, plus the destabilization of democracy? As we speak, There is movement within the legislature in Japan to make it criminal to release information that's deemed secret and goes after whistleblowers. Does that not sound familiar? What other energy technology causes that? The current status of cleanup in unit number 4 is they're trying to get the fuel out as fast as they can, and I can go into more detail on that if you're interested. The total radiation from Fukushima exceeds that of the 1986 Chernobyl catastrophe. Fukushima's the worst. When I woke up the day of that accident, even I was floored, shocked. It never occurred to me that something like this could happen to 4 nuclear reactors, not just one. 2 former prime ministers in Japan now are calling for a nuclear-free Japan. The people are gathering on the streets, demonstrating, trying to convince the current administration to not turn the reactors back on. In this country, we just had a movie called Pandora's Promise that was released by CNN, talking about how we need this energy resource to combat global warming. I suggest to you that, like my friend Joan Sasso says, this is Pandora's revenge. There's free information up here. Please take it with you. I have tried my best to bring the most relevant information that I could find. And again, I appreciate the opportunity to be here. And I think that you, of course, will walk away, hopefully, with a better understanding of what it is that we need to do in order to protect ourselves. Thank you.
Good evening, and thank you all for coming. My name is John Bertucci. I'm not a scientist. If I had to boil it down, I would say I'm an artist. And what does an artist do? An artist perceives reality and then articulates it in some form or shape. And that's what I've been trying to do all my life. I would call myself a media activist. My bête noire, my enemy, is lies. So I've been really tuned into disinfo and spin and how media is used for crowd control. It gets my blood pumping to see through it and to help other people see through it. I would say I'm not an anti-nuke activist by tradition. I became tuned into what we're looking at now really in the summer of 2010. That's when the BP Gusher took care of the Gulf forever. And what did we see a corporation do? They poured Corexit on it to protect their bottom line, even though that amplified the damage to the Gulf. So that's when I realized we were at a critical point where the titans of our world have proven themselves to be criminally oriented. They are not going to watch out for us. At that point, I was tuned in to Occupy as well. I learned a lot about regional work groups, how to work with others. That's an art form too, how to find what's in you, what you're good at, how to mesh people. Let's say that when the explosions happened in Fukushima, I knew right away what we were up against. And I also knew that we were not going to get the real story. But I didn't know what to do with it. It was huge. It's existential. I was going crazy in the Christmas of 2011. And then on New Year's Eve, I found a blog from somebody who I've since met, and we worked together in the Bay Area. And it opened the door of my heart. I was able to own my distress. And I began to think, how can I move with this? And then we had your Senator Ron Wyden, who made a trip to Fukushima and came back quite shaken. He was really pushing with a press conference and all, and a letter to a number of heads of state demanding or requesting or urging an international response. So with those two pieces, the sense that I was owning my concern, and I had a project. We started organizing in May of 2012, and right away we got the California State Democratic Party passed a resolution in support of Ron Wyden's effort. We brought Yastel Yamada and Chieko Shina to Sonoma County. We introduced them to people. We did a workshop on denial. We had a psychiatrist come and help people work through the denial. How can you embrace this, the immensity of this? But we found ourselves at the end of 2012 rather worn out. It's a lot of work to get this many people together. We wanted to reach a lot more people. We also felt that the window for the international response had closed, pretty much. They lied all through 2011, they did nothing in 2012, and the situation just got worse. So this year we set our sights on breaking the media sound barrier, and we started working with a marvelous man in Berkeley, Brad Newsham. And we organized a human mural, which brought 500 people to the beach. We lined up, we spelled the letters with our bodies, we had the helicopter, and we were hoping that image is already circulating the world, and it has become a global campaign. Now, Fukushima is here. Literally, in a way, it's not that bad yet, but it's here in the sense if you saw a picture of the galaxy, you could put an arrow and point to this little dot that is called Earth, and Fukushima is here, and it's not going away. So I'm really concerned about what it means to my grandchildren, and how I can understand the shift, the moment that we are the ones that are alive when this happened. So we have a responsibility to understand it. And if I were to boil my project and the group I'm working with, we know and we care. Thank you.
Well, my name is Dan Sears. I work with Columbia Riverkeeper, and really what I'm here to do tonight is to answer questions that you might have about Hanford.
Is it not on?
Unlike Lloyd, I actually need a microphone.
Where is the...
I don't have the bass register. That he...
You can whisper in my ear, I'll speak. Yeah.
There we go.
Is it on?
Sounds like that's on. Is that on?
Yeah.
All right. I'll lean in. So what I want to do tonight is really talk about what's going on in our own backyard with Hanford. In the last couple years, we've seen sort of a trend of the Hanford cleanup. So by way of background, right in our backyard, up in the Tri-Cities, we have the most contaminated site radiologically in North America. Not even close. It is incredibly polluted with radionuclides and with chemical contaminants in a mixture that makes it very, very difficult to clean up. There's liquid nuclear waste in tanks that are leaking. There's nuclear waste in soil that's percolating towards groundwater. There are almost 75 square miles of groundwater that are contaminated with chemical and nuclear waste above standards that are suitable for drinking. And then there is nuclear waste that's actively percolating into the Columbia River. So I'm here to raise your spirits. The incredible part about Hanford, and what I want to start with, is that it is actually a very beautiful place. If you ever get a chance to float the Hanford Reach, to go out and see Hanford, it is a jewel on the Columbia River. It is the best mainstream spawning habitat for salmon in the entire Columbia River system. When you catch a Chinook, fall Chinook, there's a chance that it spawned in the Hanford Reach, right next to those 9 reactors that you would float past in the Hanford Reach. And they, for decades, produced plutonium to make nuclear weapons. Not so much nuclear power. Hanford's legacy is much more burdened by nuclear weapon production than it is by nuclear power. Although, as Chuck will talk about, those two issues are fused now and trying to establish a good cleanup at Hanford while simultaneously having a huge nuclear power plant right next door. So kind of going forward, I want to identify that, you know, U.S. Department of Energy has essentially sidestepped public sentiment for the last several years in its cleanup efforts. And I think it's really important because many people here have gone to hearings about Hanford cleanup, and I think it's important for you to go again. And we will have more hearings coming in the spring in Portland. Our role is to put relentless pressure on Oregon Department of Energy to pressure U.S. Department of Energy to do the right thing and other agencies. So the U.S. Department of Energy is effectively arguing that most of this waste should just remain in the soil, should remain in the groundwater and be allowed to radioactively decay away. Those decisions are at play in the following areas. I'll just identify a few. First, in plutonium waste sites in the Central Plateau, which is maybe 10 miles away from the Columbia River, where they dumped liquid plutonium waste into the ground, Department of Energy came to the decision that, well, we should dig to the bottom of these trenches, but leave everything below just to remain there, arguing that plutonium would never migrate towards groundwater, ignoring the basic scientific fact, of course, that plutonium has a half-life of 24,000 years, and the river itself might move in that amount of time. And so that's one decision where they received overwhelming testimony from people in this room and from around the Northwest, and they ignored it. Just yesterday, the Department of Energy issued a decision to leave large amounts of uranium right next to the Columbia River in what's called the 300 area, where they did a lot of testing of nuclear materials and fabricating fuel rods for the reactors in the river corridor. Their approach is what they call monitored natural attenuation. We call that do nothing. And it's a euphemism for essentially letting that uranium percolate into the Columbia River for decades, if not hundreds of years. And we think that, again, establishes this disturbing trend of Department of Energy not hearing what the public is saying, which is get this stuff out of the ground, get it away from the river, and protect the public. You know, in some ways, cleanup of Hanford, and I'm sure of Fukushima, it's a euphemism. We're talking about protecting the public and putting this stuff in a place where it's not going to get into fish habitat for as long as we can, because uranium has even a longer half-life than plutonium. And now we're looking at the specter of leaking nuclear waste tanks, percolating the most toxic radioactive waste in the world into the groundwater that moves to the Columbia River. And it may take decades, but there are 56 million gallons of extremely high-level radioactive waste at Hanford that are essentially in tanks that are not suited to hold them. And we've been calling for the building of new tanks, and so far the Department of Energy and the federal government have made no commitment or no movement towards stabilizing this highly radioactive liquid waste and the sludge waste. As a result, the existing tank capacity at Hanford is becoming so vexed that they're now at risk of building up flammable gas inside these tanks and are having to assess whether the existing tanks are at risk of kind of belching out flammable gas to the extent it could actually, you know, explode or ignite. So as we look forward, I'm going to be counting on everyone in this room to be here to make sure that the slow-speed nuclear disaster we're having on the Columbia River just upstream from us gets the attention of everyone in this region, including elected officials, because without our attention, DOE will take the shortcut, and we've seen that demonstrated over and over. So thank you very much for having me.
I'm Chuck Johnson. Can you hear me? Okay. Chuck Johnson, and I'm with the Oregon and Washington chapters of Physicians for Social Responsibility. I've been working for them for the last year and a half, and got back involved in the nuclear power issue after Fukushima. I had, you know, been involved. I actually was on the board of Columbia Riverkeeper, and we'd been concerned about Hanford issues, but in a sense we'd forgotten about one of the dangers that's on the Columbia River, which is this nuclear power plant, this formerly known as Whoops 2. Some of you may remember the Washington Public Power Supply System tried to build 5 nuclear power plants in the state of Washington during the heyday of nuclear power in the 70s and 80s. And unfortunately, they managed to finish one of them. The other 4 were a bust, and 2 of those 4 were not guaranteed by anyone, and the utilities defaulted on them, and it was the largest municipal bond default in the history of the United States up until a few years ago when we had our little incidents in 2008. But up until that time, it was the largest municipal bond default. In any case, this one plant was finished. It was at the time called Washington Nuclear Plant Number 2. In the 90s, they changed its name to the Columbia Generating Station. They were going through a whole rebranding at the end of the 90s, and they changed their name from Whoops. They were still being called Whoops up until 1998, but they decided that Energy Northwest was more dignified, and so that's what they go by now. Board consists of 27 public utilities in Washington State, a few municipalities, big ones like Tacoma Power and Seattle City Light, a couple of small ones, and some public utility districts like our own across the river, Clark County PUD is a member of Energy Northwest. And these utilities have been running this reactor now for 30 years. Recently relicensed, just right after Fukushima. The NRC gave them a license to operate until 2043. One of the reasons we got concerned about this reactor was its similarity to the ones that melted down in Japan. It's a GE boiling water reactor of similar vintage to the ones that melted down. It's a slightly newer version, but it still has the same basic flaw of a very small and narrow containment vessel that can be easily overwhelmed in an accident. And the hydrogen gas can escape from it, cause explosions, as we saw in Japan. So the NRC is actually requiring Energy Northwest to put a vent system into this plant. They're not in any great hurry. They're probably going to have it done by 2017 or 2018. But this vent system then would, currently it's unvented, so there's nothing to stop an explosion if you had an accident there currently. But in a few years, they're going to be able to vent the gas, and they're debating right now whether they want to spend the money to put a filter on it or whether they'll just pipeline that accident radioactive material straight into the Tri-Cities. the other thing that Lloyd alluded to that's concerning about this design is the spent fuel pool. It's another one of these elevated pools. It's 5 stories up. If you had somehow lost the water from the bottom of that pool, you could have an overheating, and then we would have a new largest nuclear power accident ever in history, which we're staring down the barrel of right now in Fukushima. If there's an uncontrolled reaction from the spent fuel pool in number 4, we would have a much larger accident than we've currently already had from Fukushima. That type of accident can also occur at the Columbia Generating Station. Dan was saying earlier about describing all the huge amount of radioactive materials that are from the defense side at the Hanford Nuclear Reservation. The nuclear power plant has the same amount of curies of radioactivity as all of that military waste. So I think a lot of people don't really realize that each one of these nuclear power plants is really massive and has a massive amount of radioactivity associated with it. So what to do? Well, we have been approaching this, because this is an issue that no one has really thought about for decades, we've decided that we needed to really... yes, I'm getting the hook. We decided that we... that we needed to be as fact-based as possible, and let me steer you to a couple of things that we've done. We've been working with groups like No Nukes Northwest in coalition with Sierra Club, a wonderful woman locally here named Leslie March, who's been a great leader, Nancy Metella and the Alliance for Democracy, and Columbia Riverkeeper, and Heart of an American Northwest up in the Seattle area. So one of the things that we did is we hired a geologist who has experience in the region, because there's been a lot of additional seismic activity out in the Hanford area, more so than they knew about when the plant was originally built. And we had a study done. You can link to it on our website. The area is actually has potential for 3 times the ground motion that they built that plant to be able to withstand. So go to the Oregon, just Google Oregon PSR, and you can link to our information about the earthquake. And if you Google tonight, we're releasing this monster study on the economics of the Columbia Generating Station. That we hired a fellow named Robert McCullough, who used to work for Portland General Electric. Lloyd remembers him. He's a kind of a gadfly economist, a very interesting guy. There's going to be a feature in the in tomorrow's Willamette Week. Look for it. So, I'm getting the hook, and I'm going to heed the hook. So, feel free to ask questions. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Malcolm Chaddick. I'm with Veterans for Peace in No Nukes Northwest. And I am here to answer the local kind of the Portland angle of what is No Nukes Northwest and what are we doing and how are we doing it and that kind of thing. Don't really have a lot of lead-in except for to say that we've been after Fukushima ever since it began. And ever since then, have been trying to beat our way through this wall of obfuscation that surrounds this kind of information. Hopefully, within a very short time, we'll be able to help bring some tools to you that will help you to be able to visualize this stuff a little bit better on the internet. More about that later. But thank you all for coming. And we've got a lot of work to do. Glad to see you're here.
My name is Kriana, and I'm just like you. I'm a community member here in Portland. I'm a mother and a wife, and I care about this issue. Growing up, my dad, and he still is actually a nuclear safety engineer, and you can imagine the arguments in our household. So I'm here to, I'd like to have all of us hold a space of compassion for all of the different perspectives on this issue and work together at building bridges between everyone, because these people who work in the nuclear power plants are our families. They're our people, they're humans just like us. And yes, this issue is important. As you come up and ask your questions, you're going to be using this microphone. So please make the line this way and to the side, okay? And then before you come up and ask your question, if you also can be sure and be very concise and clear about what you're asking before you come to the microphone. Are we ready?
Hey, Kriana, is this on still? Yeah. Okay, it's a quiet mic. I think instead of a line, we'll just have one person at a time come up and everyone can be seated.
Okay, sure.
Okay, cool. There's one there.
Yeah.
Alternative energy. It seems like we should be talking about that. There's a website called newenergymovement.org. They had a big expo thing here in Portland, I think it was 2004. Lots of booths and speakers for 3 days. And the last speaker was Charles Greer, I think his name is. And he said, as you can see, there's no problem coming up with alternatives. The problem is politics. Can you speak to how we can get around the politics of it?
I was looking at the Alliance for Democracy newsletter, and there was a quote from, I think, Ronnie Diggers, in which he said, the issue is not the issues. The issue is democracy, taking the system back. And that really is, you know, I think what we confront. We cannot make the changes that we need to make until we can begin to once again have a democracy that is not controlled by corporate interests and big moneyed interests, but in essence is open to the people. If we don't get to that, I don't know where we're going to end up. And I'll tell you, we confront a big issue here because it's not just nuclear power. We've got to take fossil fuels out, and we've got to take nuclear power out. We've got to make a commitment to solar energy, but we can't fool ourselves that it's just an energy resource substitution. What it is it's a transformation in the way we as a people live. And I know that we're all at work on that, but it is that is the ultimate goal. And so it is kind of everything hitting you all at once, but by God, if we don't stand up to it, we're gone anyway.
I'd like to add one other thing is, in terms of a model, we can look at some of the countries in Europe that have been actually doing some very active work in converting their societies. Denmark, for many years, has been promoting wind energy, and I think they're 80% renewable right now in terms of their electricity. And Portugal's pretty close behind. There's a lot of renewables in Spain. But Germany is the most dramatic because Germany is a country that's very heavily industrial and uses a lot of power. But the amount of the shift, and the rapidity of the shift, and the amount of solar energy that they're generating in Germany right now is really exciting. It's amazing because that country gets less solar power than we do here. And yet between solar and wind, they're over 25% of their electricity is coming from that, and it's going up by 3, 4, 5% annually. It's changing so rapidly.
And just to address that further, in Germany, the reason that Germany is doing so well with solar right now is because after Fukushima happened, 6 months later, the people of Germany went out into the streets. For those of you who don't know this, you can Google the Germany, I don't know, maybe it's uprising against nukes or something. They all went out in the tens of thousands and marched through Germany saying, and including Angela Merkel, saying, okay, we're going to shut this down. And they created a plan on the spot to shut down every single nuke power plant in Germany according to a time frame that actually made sense. So that's people power.
I wanted to ask about the leakage that's going on in the Tri-Cities, because I'm looking at grocery stores and I'm looking at potatoes and root vegetables, and they're coming from USA, and when you look closer, they're coming from Tri-City. And I'm very hesitant to buy anything coming out of Washington from there. So I also remember the DOE, Oregon's DOE, talking about being able to find nuclear radiation waste within the plants at the docks on Columbia, and that they're showing up, that it's really hard to see them in the water, but they're showing up in the organics. And I would want to have maybe that addressed as well. How do we bring that forward to the communities so that when we do press our local governments, we actually have something in our hands to say, look, this is actually happening.
Yeah, I think, and I'll be honest, in terms of what I understand, I think that crops in the immediate vicinity of Hanford aren't the main risk. Right now, are not the main risk. I think that one of the things we're looking at is, you know, if you had a release simultaneously between Columbia Generating Station and another Hanford facility, we're looking at half the wheat crop, you know, of eastern Washington and Oregon being impacted. So it's a real risk to our food supply. You can look in past history, and there are people here who are much more knowledgeable than I about the downwinder cases where releases from Hanford absolutely contributed to
deliberate releases.
Thank you. Yeah, to people becoming sickened by radiation from Hanford. I think in terms of the river, it's important to recognize that there is absolutely nuclear waste getting into the river from Hanford today. DOE does not dispute this. They find it in fish tissue. They find it in plants next to the river, so much so that the idea of planting vegetation along the river to take up that nuclear waste is a controversial part of the cleanup strategy, where people are worried that you're just concentrating it into plant tissues and bringing it up out of the soil towards the air where it could be more readily released.
Well, hey.
So the river corridor of Hanford needs a much more aggressive cleanup strategy. We need to get that stuff away from these biological receptors much more aggressively than is being planned by Department of Energy. So I think you've identified a really key issue. There are going to be multiple decisions coming up in the next year about how to approach this. And I think they need to get an earful from people around the region saying, the Columbia River is too big to fail at Hanford, and we need you to keep that stuff out of the river in any level.
Thank you.
So thank you.
I think food choices are terribly important. I mean, we can protect ourselves ultimately by the beginning choice. What is it that we're going to purchase? Purchasing organic gives you some assurance that at least there's an effort being made to keep contaminants out of the food supply. So those are choices that you can make. But I got to tell you, I think that if we really are serious about protecting our food, then what Chuck's doing is the important thing. And what Dan's trying to do about Hanford, what we've got to do is we've got to contain this industry. We've got to turn it around and we've got to begin. And it's going to take a World War II effort. It means that really we as a people are going to have to rise to the occasion and make massive changes in our lives in order to bring it about. But we got no choice. We got no choice. We got to do it. So it's not just a simple choice of what you're going to eat. It's also a choice of what you're going to allow in your environment, to operate in your environment.
So from the activism standpoint in what Lloyd is talking about, there's always, it always comes around, and Dan can address this further on the when and how people can find out about these. But I've been to many, the DOE and the Tri-Party Agreement, which has to do with the DOE, the Department of Ecology, and the Oregon Department of Energy.
EPA.
They come together for big decisions, and they have to come out to the community. So that is our opportunity. Just like here, there's over 100 people here. I wanted to count because I don't do well just by looking. And if we all show up when these Hanford, what are they called, Dan? I just go to them. The public hearings occur, and they're also in the paper when they occur, or you can get on an email list from Dan. If we show up, it actually matters. And they've said, I don't know if this is true, okay? I always question what I hear from the government, but they have said, I think it was the Oregon Department of Energy, that it actually matters to them in their decision-making process if people show up or not. That they have to do what we are saying, at least take it into high priority. Is that right, Dan?
That's right. And I think part of what it does is give part of what it does is it gives the agencies that might have a little bit more of a critical approach on this, a little bit more backbone. So the Washington Department of Ecology and the Oregon Department of Energy, by the way, has done great work in watchdogging this stuff. And they really watch the groundwater. They watch the soil pollution. They have smart people looking at this. And so I want to give them some credit. But it takes these agencies to criticize the shortcut approach from Department of Energy. And so far, Department of Energy is blowing right past these guys. And so we need to ramp it up.
I might point out something also, too, because I think it's important to keep this in mind. There is a synergistic effect that's taking place here. When Chuck talks about earthquake, increased earthquake activity at the Columbia Generating Station, that increased earthquake activity is also affecting Hanford. When they go to do the glassification at Hanford, when you look at the analysis of this facility that's supposed to turn all that waste into glass, there's serious problems that can happen if there's major disruptions in that whole cycle of the waste going from the tanks into that facility. If there's contamination released from Columbia Generating Station, that affects Hanford and its cleanup. If there's an accident at Hanford, that affects the operation of the Columbia Generating Station. We got a major book of matches sitting upriver that we got to try and stop from catching fire.
Classic country and western fans, tune in fourth Saturday of the month from 6 to 9 a.m. for my classic country sound of 60s through 80s country western music. That's fourth Saturday of the month from 6 to 9 a.m. 90.7 FM or KBOO.FM on the web.
Thank you so much for listening to our KBOO's presentation of our panel discussion and taking questions. You can hear part two on Monday right here at 11 a.m. on KBOO Portland, where the time is approximately 11:59 a.m. Coming up at noon, we have Don Jacobson, the inestimable. I'm just going to skip that and say, what a guy. He's your host today on Moving On. And that's about the time for the incomparable Radio Zine on KBOO Portland. Stay tuned.
For the KBOO News at Noon for Thursday, December 26th, my name is Kristen Yount. Two different subgroups of the United Nations came out with condemnations over the last couple of days. United Nations Relief and Works Agency spoke out against Israel and the demolition of Bedouin housing in Palestine on Christmas Eve. The destruction of the housing displaces at least 68 people. Children comprise roughly half of those. This number adds to the 1,103 Palestinians that have been displaced in 2013. The demolition left livestock reserves of 750 goat and sheep without shelter. Israeli officials claim that they only remove buildings that are built without permission, but Palestinians say that permits are not attainable. Amnesty International, Oxfam, and the Human Rights Watch issued a joint demand for Israel to stop expanding settlements and displacing people and respect international law. In the United Kingdom, stringent immigration laws proposed by Prime Minister James Cameron grabbed the attention of the United Nations High Commission for Refugees, or the UNHCR. A letter drafted by the UNHCR's High Commissioner talked about how asylum seekers and refugees could be profiled and denied housing because the laws would levy fines on landlords renting to undocumented people. Banks doing business with certain immigrants could face penalties, and people would be asked to pay for civil services rendered if they are not citizens. The laws would make it very easy for misinterpretation of immigration status and for ethnic profiling in every facet of daily life. On Christmas Day in South America, a piranha feeding fest resulted in injuries for 60 people. The unusual attack left hospitals workers confused in the Argentine city of Rosario. Cichlids in the river, aptly named the Piranha River, normally only bite every so often in isolated cases. Warm temperatures yesterday sent many to the river to find relief, churning up trouble, and officials say the heat of the river may have been a factor in the fish hanging out en masse on the surface of the water. It's time for the KBOO News at Noon for Friday, December 27th. I'm Kristen Yount. A powerful explosion in Beirut this morning killed at least 15 individuals, including Lebanese official Mohammed Chatta. Mohammed Chatta actively stood against Hezbollah and Bashar al-Assad's regime in Syria. Mohammed Chatta, senior aide to former Lebanese Prime Minister Saad Harari, was the second senior opposition figure to have been killed in the last 14 months. Officials presume that Chatta was the target of the explosion delivered by car bomb, and he could have been en route to a meeting with Harari. Harari has been in exile for 3 years for his views. Today's bombing comes just weeks before the long-awaited trial of 5 Hezbollah members in The Hague regarding the murder of another past prime minister.